All right, good morning, everyone. So I know this is our last class for this particular semester, and of course our topic is Sefer Tehillim, but being that tonight the Emirat Hashem is Lag BaOmer, so I wanted to take the opportunity really to speak a little bit about the meaning, the profound meaning of this particular day. You know, there are some days on the Jewish calendar that we know are important, but we're not exactly sure why they're important. So I'd like to try to focus a little bit on the deeper meaning of Lag BaOmer, and hopefully we'll emerge from this year with a greater appreciation, understanding, and really connection to this special day. So let's begin with number one. So the Shulchan Aruch writes, Noagim Shelo Lisa Isha Ben Pesach La'atzeres. The custom is that we do not get married between Pesach and Shavuos. Now, of course, we know that although the Shulchan Aruch makes this statement, there are many other customs in terms of, here's what we know. Everyone observes some period of prohibition on getting married. Which period one observes between Pesach and Lag BaOmer, Rosh Chodesh, Lag BaOmer, and then again picking up, is not our topic for today. But the point is that these particular days between Pesach and Shavuos, says the Shulchan Aruch, we don't get married. Furthermore, the Shulchan Aruch says in number two, Noagim shol lehistaper. Many have the custom, and again, you'll notice the wording of the Shulchan Aruch is noagim. Noagim means what? It's customary. The practices that we observe over the course of Siras HaOmer, over the Omer, are not halachic obligations. They're not biblical obligations. They're not even rabbinic obligations. They're minhagim. They're customs. So there's a custom, number one, not to marry. There's a custom, number two, not to get a haircut, not to shave. Again, different customs in terms of when exactly these prohibitions are observed, but nevertheless, they're customs. Yet the Shulchan Aruch says in number three, but the custom is we take haircuts on the 33rd day of the Omer. Umarbim bo kitzas simcha. And we celebrate a little bit. Now, even that verbiage is very strange. What do you mean we celebrate a little bit? Either we celebrate or we don't celebrate. Be a little bit happy, but not too happy. Right? Celebrate a bit, but don't get carried away. We don't generally see these concepts. So yet we know the mourning obligations are lifted on the day of Lag BaOmer. Now, of course, just to highlight why this is unique. So many have the custom to observe the mourning practices. Let's say again, from the beginning of the Omer until Lag BaOmer. So the notion then that Lag BaOmer, the mourning practices end, okay. But you know, many have a different custom, which is many observe the mourning practices from Rosh Chodesh Iyar all the way through, let's say, a couple of days before Shavuos, or until Rosh Chodesh Sivan. Which means then, what happens for many is, the mourning practices are lifted on Lag BaOmer, and then what happens on Lad BaOmer, what happens on the 34th day of the Omer? Everything returns. Which is even more strange. Because to say that mourning ends at Lag BaOmer, and then okay, we're finished, is one thing. But to say mourning is lifted for this one day, and then resumes the following day, for the rest of the Omer, or for some major part of the Omer, is exceptionally strange. So the question I'm going to try to focus on this morning is, what is the meaning of mourning on the Omer? That's question number one. What is it that we are mourning? Especially given the fact that, remember, we read just in last week's parasha of the mitzvah of Siras HaOmer. And remember, when the Torah discusses the mitzvah of Siras HaOmer, so all the Torah says is, Usvartam lachami macharas ha-shabbos, you shall count from the second day of Pesach, you'll count 7 weeks. There's no discussion about mourning. There's no discussion about sadness. There's no discussion about anything other than a simple count between the Yom Tov of Pesach and the Yom Tov of Shavuos. Meaning, from a biblical perspective, what is the meaning of counting the Omer? It's very simple. To teach us that Exodus was not a means, Exodus is an ends. Meaning, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu take us out of Egypt? It was not simply to allow us to be free. It was not simply to allow us to shake off the shackles of a human master. The point of leaving Egypt was to experience Sinaitic revelation. The entire point of our existence is to accept and to live Torah. Therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes that point by linking the two experiences. The moment we leave Pesach, we celebrate for a day. Yes, we're free. Wonderful. That's the Seder. And then immediately right afterwards, we begin counting towards Matan Torah, towards Sinaitic revelation. There is no freedom without Torah. There is no freedom without a relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's no meaning in life without some deep spiritual underpinning. So that's the Torah's perspective on Sira. Yet we see the Halacha tells us that there's a strong element of mourning over the course of these days. So question number one is, what is the meaning of the mourning? Now, just so you appreciate that, you understand in Judaism, mourning is never an end. Mourning is always a means. So for example, if you take a look at number four, the Geshe HaChaim is probably one of the most authoritative Sfarim written on the laws of Avelis, the laws of mourning, written by Rabbi Chiel Michal Tukachinsky, who was one of the great Rabbanim in Yushalayim. So he writes the following. He says in number four, Mitzas HaAvelos Mahi. So this is a much deeper discussion, which we're not going to get into now. Maybe over the course of the 3 weeks, this is a proper discussion. Why do we mourn? You know, if you think about it, we believe in Olam Haba. We believe in the world to come. We believe that when someone leaves this world, ultimately they go to a much better, more beautiful place without pain, without suffering, without hatred, place where they get to go close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Geshe HaChaim says, so why do we mourn? If I really believe in an afterlife, and I really believe that my loved one is somewhere better, why am I mourning? So of course, the simple answer is, I'm not mourning for them, I'm mourning for me. Meaning, I'm happy for where they are, I'm sad for me that I now have my life without my loved one. That's what I'm crying for. But the Geshe HaChaim says something additional. He says, Hatam, Hamufchar, he says, Lahashrish es chashivus, chashivus chaye ha'adam. So Rav Tukachinsky says, the point of Avelos is to reinforce within us the importance of life. In other words, what's the greatest challenge of life, if we're honest with ourselves? The greatest challenge is most of us live thinking that life is an infinite renewable resource. Right? No need to accomplish what I need to accomplish today. Why? There's always tomorrow. And right, and when I keep making that argument for the last 10 years of my life, no problem, because there's the next 10 years. So the truth is, when a person goes to be Menachem Avo, when a person goes to pay a Shiva visit, the one reality that I am confounded by is that life is a finite, non-renewable resource. Therefore, says Rav Tukachinsky, the entire point of Avelos is a learning lesson. Everything in Judaism is a learning lesson. We don't mourn simply because I'm sad because I lost a loved one. We certainly aren't mourning for the person who passed away because we believe they're somewhere better. We mourn because there's something I'm supposed to learn from the process of mourning. And specifically, that is that life is a finite, non-renewable resource. Every moment must be maximized. Every day must be utilized, for we know not how much time HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us on this world. Same way in number five, the Gemara Maseches Tainis writes, Kol HaMis'abel al Yerushalayim Zochev Ra B'Simchasa. You know, we do so many things. We do so many things in our Judaism to remember the Beis HaMikdash. We remember things to replicate the Beis HaMikdash. Remember things. Why? Why are we always remembering the Beis HaMikdash? Because the hope is, bless you, if we mourn for the Beis HaMikdash, that hopefully awakens within us a desire, a yearning, a pining for the third Beis HaMikdash. So the point that I'm making to you over here is that mourning is never an end. Mourning is a means. The goal of mourning is to have some new level of awareness, some new level of understanding. So therefore, question number one is, what is the meaning of the mourning of Sfira? What is it that we're mourning, and what is it that we're supposed to learn? And question number two is, therefore, what is it that we're celebrating a Lag BaOmer? What is the nature of this celebration, and what is this thing that the Shulchan Aruch calls Marbim Bo Kitsas Simcha? Meaning, either I'm happy or I'm not happy. Either the Simcha is not Simcha. What does it mean, Kitsas Simcha? So to analyze this, we're going to look at a couple of different approaches. If you look at number six, so this is a beautiful piece by the Rav. Rav Soloveitchik writes, he says, that is exactly the problem with which the Torah is concerned when it tells us about the Omer. Now, the Rav is not addressing our question. The Rav just happens to be speaking about the dynamic of the Omer. But I think we'll be able to use his understanding to answer our question, what we're mourning for. So the Rav says, the celebration of the Passover festival commemorates a different historical experience. The order of divine revelation in history. There are no problems, no doubts, no opposition. You know, the beautiful part about Pesach is, if you think about the Yom Tov of Pesach, is it's a Yom Tov of perfection. Meaning HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes us out and everything is perfectly choreographed. Everything, you know, to the point, you know, the Torah records a very interesting fact. Torah says that when Klal Yisrael were leaving Egypt, Torah says, U'lechol b'nei Yisrael lo yacharatz kelev l'shono. right? For every Jewish person, the dogs didn't even bark. So you'll ask, what's the obvious question? Who cares? Dogs bark, dogs don't bark. What's the point? Why does the Torah tell me the dogs didn't bark? And what's the answer? So the Torah and others explain, because Yetzias Hashem was so perfectly choreographed that everything went according to plan. There was nothing that didn't happen that wasn't in the script. Even the dogs were in on it. Right? The dogs were quiet also. The dogs just nodded accordingly. Yes, the Jews are leaving Egypt. This is the Ratzon Hashem. This is the way it's supposed to unfold. Everything was perfect, says the Rav. There are no problems, no doubts, no opposition. However, with the arrival in the promised land, the order will change. The manna will stop coming down. The Jew will have to till, plant, water, and reap. Is it possible to fulfill the commitment while living in a natural order? Is it possible to live as a Jew in the natural dimension of history? Will the commitment to the covenant be affected by the transition from a transcendental to a concrete natural existence? The Torah devotes a full section to this problem. So the Rav says something amazing. Right after Pesach. So again, I have the Yom Tov of Pesach, which celebrates this perfect miracle. Now, why is it perfect? Why is Pesach perfect? Because God does everything, right? Pesach is perfect because the Ribono Shel Olam does everything. And God is perfect. So when God choreographs all the details, when God is the party planner, right? When God is the one who's planning, everything works perfectly. That's Pesach. Then what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu say? Mimacharas HaShabbos, on the day after Pesach, I want you to bring the Omer. What does the Omer represent? The Omer is brought from barley. In order to have barley, what do you have to do? Right? You have to plant. You have to till the soil. You have to water it. You have to rely on the elements. You have to live with uncertainty. So the Ribono Shel Olam says to us, Pesach is great. Pesach is beautiful. It's wonderful. And that's why, by the way, there is, I really think, a certain euphoria on Pesach that is not experienced on other Yomim Tovim. There's something different. I'm not talking about the preparations for Pesach. I'm talking about on Pesach itself, there's a certain euphoric feeling of simcha. When you're sitting at the seder, there's a certain wave of spiritual energy that overtakes you different than any other Yom Tov. That's because God did everything. It's perfect. It's absolutely perfect. There's not one part of the story that you could look back to and say, maybe we could have done this a little bit differently, that a little bit different. It's perfect. But what happens? Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm not going to be choreographing your whole life for you. I'm not going to be taking care of everything for you. There's going to come a time where you're going to go into the land. You're going to have to plant. You're going to have to reap. You're going to have to go ahead and harvest. And there's going to be a lot of uncertainty. We transition, the Rav says, from the transcendental to the concrete natural existence. Second paragraph. Even in the midst of the natural order, the Jew will take the first sheaf of the harvest, no matter how little he will have for himself, and bring it to the priest who will lift up the sheaf. In other words, the sheaf of barley, for he cannot afford to cultivate wheat, will be raised and hallowed. You know, in general, that barley is not used for sacrificial service. Why is barley not used for sacrificial service? It's because it's called Michael Behema. It's animal food. The Torah assumes, you have to understand something, meaning it's only a new thing that people actually want, like whole wheat. You know, from a Judaic perspective, that's considered to be that's what like the poor people ate. You know, now it's interesting how trends develop. Now we pay more for that which was considered to be inferior. No one eats barley, says the Gemara. The only things you give barley to is an animal. In fact, there are only two times where barley is used as part of sacrificial service. One of them is the Omer. The other time is by the Isha Sota, the woman who's suspected of adultery. Her offering is brought from barley, highlighting the idea that her actions are not human. Her actions are more animalistic than they are proper human behavior. So why barley here? So the Rav says, you know what barley represents? Barley represents difficulties. Barley represents the fact that, you know what, sometimes you're not going to get wheat. Sometimes you're not going to get what you want out of life. And sometimes you don't even get what you plant. Sometimes you put your efforts into one thing and life gives you back something else. But even if all life gives you is barley, you're still going to take it to the Kohen. You're still going to use it for sacrificial service. However arduous, turn the page. However arduous the job of cultivating the soil and raising the limited amount of food, the Jew will bring the sheaf to the priest so that he can raise and sanctify it. That is why the Omer is separated from the Passover ceremonial and formulated in a separate section, for Passover and the Omer represent two opposite historical orders. So this is a magnificent piece by the Rav. So Pesach on one hand represents the Ribono Shel Olam does everything. God does everything. And because He does everything, it's perfect. And the Omer represents when God hands the baton to us. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, here, now you try. Now you try. And when we try, it's not going to be perfect. And when we try, we often don't get the results we wanted. And when we try, I want wheat, but I end up getting barley. But it's okay, because I'm still going to bring my barley to the Beis HaMikdash. I'm going to find God even in the imperfection of my circumstances. I'm going to find HaKadosh Baruch Hu even in the compromised circumstances. Two polar opposite experiences. The perfection of Pesach versus the normalcy or mundanity of the Omer. So it could be that according to the Rav's idea, this is also part of the mourning of the Omer. That part of the mourning of the Omer is the sadness. You know, there is some. You know why Pesach is so beautiful? Because when we read in the Haggadah, Ani v'lo malach, Ani v'lo sarach, Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I love you so much that I took care of you on my own. I split the sea for you. I brought down the man for you. I protected you. My clouds were in front of you. My fire warmed you. There's something beautiful about that. Because the truth is, one of the most beautiful feelings in life is being taken care of. Being taken care of. Knowing that somebody who loves me, I'm cocooned in their love, I'm cocooned in their embrace. There's a feeling of security. There's a feeling of belonging. There's a feeling of acceptance. And we had that. We had that. Now the truth is our ancestors had it for 40 years. We have it for a day. We have it for a day of Pesach. And then we switch into Omer mode. There's a sadness associated with it. I understand why it has to be that way. I can't live my life subsisting on man. I have to plant my own food. I can't wait for the seas to split in front of me. I have to learn how to swim. I understand why it has to be that way. But I'm sad. Because it was nice to have that feeling of being totally cocooned in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's embrace. But I recognize now I have to transition to the Omer, and there's a certain element of sadness associated with that. But of course, the more well-known approach for the morning of the Omer comes in number 7. The Gemara Maseches Yevamos quotes the sign Rabbi Yoshua Omer, Nasa Adam Isha Bialduso, Yisa Isha Bizeknuso. If a person was married in his youth and that marriage ended, a person should marry again in his old age. Hayulabanim Bialduso, if a person had children in his youth, Yilabanim Bizeknuso, person that have children when they're older as well, Shine Emar, because the Pasuk says, Baboke Zara Zaracha, in the morning you shall sow your seed, Ula Erev Avtanach Yadecha, and in the evening, don't withdraw your hand. Why? Ki incha yodea eze yikasher hazeh ozeh. Because in life, you never know which of your efforts are going to bear fruit. V'im shneim ke'echad, and if both efforts work, then tovim, then wonderful. In other words, what the Pasuk in Kohelet is saying, what Shlomo Melech is saying is, in life, never stop putting in effort. Because you never know which efforts yield fruit and which efforts hit a dead end. So if you spend your life trying and constantly putting in effort, the statistical probability is something will succeed. Something will succeed. And maybe you'll be one of those very lucky individuals where all of your efforts bear fruit, matov u'manoim. How even better. That's not the norm. Most of us, again, have some things that succeed, some things that fail. But some people succeed in everything, Baruch Hashem. So therefore, the Gemara is telling us the idea that even if you've put in effort in certain things in your youth, don't stop putting in effort even in your older years as well. Because at the end of the day, you never know which efforts will endure, which efforts will yield fruit. Fine. That's beautiful Gemara. Rabbi Akiva comes along and says, Lo matar bialduso, yimotar bizeknuso. If a person learned a lot in his youth, make sure to continue to learn in your old age. Hayulo tamidim bialduso. If you had students in your youth, yotamidim bizeknuso. Don't stop teaching students even in your old age. And Rabbi Akiva quotes the same pasuk. Says the Gemara, lest you think that Rabbi Akiva is just teaching a nice lesson, Rabbi Akiva lived this. How do we know? Amru, shneim asar zugim tamidim hayulo Rabbi Akiva. Megivas Adantipris. Rabbi Kiva had 12,000 pairs of students, 24,000 students, from Givas Adantipris, which means from one end of the country to the other end, Eretz Yisrael. Vekulam Mesu Beperakacha. They all died at one time. Mipnei Shelo Nagu Kavod Zelaze. Because they did not give honor. Now, I'm not going to get into what this means. We spoke about this a little bit on Shabbos. It's a complex discussion in general. What does this mean that they didn't give honor to one another? What does that mean, A? And B, is it such a severe infraction that it should require the death of 24,000 great Torah scholars? But a different, we'll do it next year. V'hai olam shamim. So what happens? 24,000 students died. Now you understand, of course, when 24,000 students died, these were not just students, these were the Torah elite. Rabbi Akiva was training the leaders of the next generation. That entire group, that entire cohort is wiped out. There is an existential danger to the continuity of Torah. Who is going to teach? Who is going to lead? Who is going to inspire? So there was an existential danger to the world at Shabbat Rabbi Akiva until Rabbi Akiva came to the rabbis in the south of the country. In other words, Rabbi Akiva said, I lost 24,000. I have to continue to teach more. And he took on new students. Who were his new students? Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, and Rabbi Lazar ben Shamua. V'heim heim he'emidu Torah achasha. Ultimately, osasha. These five students then came along and they became the new students of Rabbi Akiva. And together with the Rebbe Rabbi Akiva, they rebuilt the Torah community. And says the Gemara, Tana, kulam mesu mi Pesach va'ad Atzeres. All of them died between Pesach and Shavuos. So from here we see the Gemara explicitly tells us that what's the nature of the mourning that we have over the course of Sira? It's over the death of Rabbi Akiva's 24,000 students. Now, there are many things that we can learn from this particular episode. I'm going to draw your attention to two lessons. So take a look for a moment at number 9. So we actually learned this together in one of our Tehillim Shiurim last year. So remember again, there's much of Sefer Tehillim. Much of the friction in David HaMelech's life traces itself to one episode, and that's the episode with Bathsheba. So we're not going to get into now, we spent a lot of time speaking about that episode, understanding that episode, but suffice it to say, that episode was the cause of much difficulty for David HaMelech throughout his life. So remember, after David HaMelech commits the misdeed with Bathsheba, so the Navi comes to David HaMelech and tells him two things. Number one, Bathsheba was pregnant. So the Navi told him, the child is going to die. That's a punishment to you. It's a punishment to you and Bathsheba for this act. The child's going to die. That was punishment number one. Punishment number two is that there's going to be a rebellion from within your household. That there's going to be one of your children is going to rebel against you. So we know that occurs later on with whose rebellion? Avshalom. And now the Navi, this is in Shmuel Beis, Perikur Beis, is talking about when Bathsheba now is by Yomer David al-Nasan, Chatosi la'Hashem. So remember, David HaMelech does tshuva. He does tshuva for the act. And Nasan says, okay, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has accepted your tshuva, but if you look in 9, Pasuk Yedal Efes, Ki niyet ni'atzta es oivi Hashem adavar hazeh, gam habein hayilod lecha mos yamos. The Navi says, David, the Ribono Shel Olam has accepted your tshuva, but the baby that you're going to have with Bathsheba, this first child, is going to die. In other words, that the tshuva is accepted, but there is going to be fallout and repercussions from your actions, and therefore the baby is going to die. So the Navi then goes on to explain, the baby's born, the baby's sick from the time that it's born. David HaMelech is fasting, he's crying, he's davening, he's prostrating himself on the floor, he's wearing sackcloth. Again, anything that he can do within his power to try to save his little son, to try to save his little baby. So if you skip to the end of section 9, so what happens? Vahi bayom ha-shvi'i was on, Pasuk Yud Ches, it was on the seventh day. Vayomas hayeled, the baby died. Vayiru avdei David lahagid kimeis hayeled ki amru, hinei bios hayeled chai dibarno elav lo shama, bikolin ve'eich nomar alav emeis hayeled asara. So what happens? Remember, this entire time, David HaMelech is fasting and crying for 7 days, and his servants are begging him, you have to eat. You have to take care of, you're the king. You're the king. You know, the great responsibility of leadership is you don't have the luxury of just simply being a private person. You have a public persona. I understand you're mourning for your son. You're also king. So you have to go out. You have to eat. You have to drink. You have to take care of yourself. David HaMelech won't say anything. The baby dies. The servants are petrified. What are we going to say to David? Now we see how he's been behaving over the last 7 days when the baby's been sick. What's going to happen now when, unfortunately, now the baby's dead? So they don't say anything to him. The Navi says, David realizes that the baby has died. He's able to see from the behavior of his servants that the baby has passed away. Number 10. So what happens? Vayakam David me'aretz, vayirchatz, vayosech, vayichalif simosav, vayavo beis Hashem, vayishtachu, vayavo beisav, vayishtav, vayasimu lechem v'yochal. Then something dramatically strange occurs. David HaMelech gets up, he washes himself, he changes his clothing, he puts on regular clothing, he comes to the table, and he sits down and he eats. Vayimra avada vaylav ma'adav razeh ashasisa. So the servants, you know, the servants obviously have to be respectful of the king. But the servants themselves are so puzzled by this. I don't understand. When the baby was dying, you were a mess, inconsolable, and no one could even speak to you. Now your son is dead, and now you're getting up, and you're getting changed, and you're coming, and you're sitting down to eat. What's the pshat? How do we understand your actions? So David HaMelech says something amazing. Pasuk Chaf Beis, verse 22. So David HaMelech says something amazing. He says, look, while the child was alive, there was hope. While the child was alive, I knew, you know, that there's an important idea. You say, what do you mean there was hope? The Navi told you that the baby's going to die. So David HaMelech says, I don't care what the Navi says. I have a relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. So whatever the Navi says or doesn't say, I know that there's always the possibility that things could change. So where there's life, there's hope. So I davened for my son. I begged for my son. I supplicated for my son. Va'ata meis. But now my son has passed away. Lama ze'anitzam. What good is my fasting going to do? Ha'uchal lo hushivo? Can I bring him back? So odani holeich elav. I'll see my son again. I'll see him one day. But I'm going to go to him. He'll never come back to me. So David HaMelech says something absolutely profound. David HaMelech says to his servants that when there is hope, I try to do whatever I can to change my circumstances. But when my circumstances are unchangeable, I must find the strength to accept them. So what am I going to do? I'm still going to cry? I'm going to keep my sackcloth on? I'm going to continue to fast? And what? And what? I can't change these circumstances. These circumstances are what they are. So I have a choice. I could spend all of my emotional and mental energy wishing and pining for what I wish life was, but I can't change anything. This is my reality. So instead, says David, I choose to accept and engage and ultimately maximize my current reality, no matter how compromised it would be, instead of spending all of my emotional and spiritual energy lamenting what is and wishing for something else. If you take a look at number 11, this is a very dramatic medrash. I think it's one of the most moving midrashim. The medrash says, Eshes chayal miyimtza. So it's quoting from the Pasuk in Mishlei, of woman of valor who can find. So the Gemara gives an example of a woman of valor. Rabbi Meir, now understand, by the way, just so you see how all of this is going to come together. You notice again, going back for just a moment. You don't have to go back, I'll just tell you. But if you go back to number 7, the Gemara says, after Rabbi Akiva's 24,000 students, after just died, he had to find new students. Who was the first new student that he found who's mentioned in the Gemara? Rabbi Meir. Okay, so just bear this in mind. Rabbi Meir was once giving a shir, Shabbos afternoon based medrash. Umesu shnei banav. His sons died. Rabbi Meir had two sons. The Medrash doesn't tell us what happened, but something happened, they died. Ma asa sa'iman, what did their mother do? Hinichan shnein ala mito persha sadin aleihem. Their mother laid them down on the bed and put a sheet over them. B'matzi Shabbos bar Rabbi Meir beis HaMedrash lebeiso. Rabbi Meir comes home and he says to his wife, Amar la heichan shnei banai. He says to her, where are my sons? So she, it's amazing, she doesn't have the heart. She doesn't have the heart to tell him yet. So she says to him, Amar la beis HaMedrash halchu. They went to the beis HaMedrash. That's interesting. I was in the base medrash. I didn't see my sons. She says, don't worry. She gave him a cup for Abdullah. He made Abdullah. And again he asks, where are my sons? They went somewhere far away, but I'm sure they're returning home. He kriva la fun of ma'achal va'achal u'beirach. She brought before him food, yad malav malka. La'achar she'beirach amrlo. So listen to this exchange. Rabbi Meir's wife said to him, she said, Rabbi, she called him Rabbi. She'la achas yeshi yishalacha. I have one question for you, my dear husband. Amrlo imri she'la seich. Please ask. She says to him, kodim hayom ba'adam echad v'nasan lipikadam. So she said, you know, the other day a man came to the house and he gave me something. A pikadon means an object to watch for him. He gave me an object and he asked me to watch it for him. La'achshav ba'alital also. And now this man came back and he asked for the pikadon, he asked for the object back. Nachzir lo olo. Tell me, my husband, am I obligated to give the ba'al pikadon, the owner of the object, am I obligated to give him his object back or not? Well, thank you very much. Thank you. So she says to him, So Rabbi Meir responds, of course, if somebody deposited something with you and it's not yours and they ask for it back, you have to give it back. Now that you said this, I want to tell you something. Ma'asasa, what did she do? And it's such a moving medrash. Tafasto biyado. She took her husband's hand in her own. Veheala osala osachede. She took him into the room. Vekriva osala mita. She took him to the bed. Venatla sadame. And she pulled back the sheet. Vera'a shnehem mesim umunachim alamita. And he saw his two beloved sons there. Hischil bocheva omer. Bonai, bonai, Rabbi, Rabbi. He began to cry. So, b'ni b'derech eretz, Rabbi Shoyim, ma'irin p'nei b'toras. And they were young, budding, tamidei chachamim. Ba'osa shah, amru lo Rabbi Meir, Rabbi, lo kach amart li, ani tzarech lahachzir ha'pikadon l'rabo. So, as Rabbi Meir is crying, his wife says to him, did you not tell me before that you have to give back the object to the owner? Did you not tell me before that when somebody deposits something with you, that you have an obligation to give it back? Amar Bimir said, you're right. Hashem Nasan, Hashem Lakach, Yehi Shem Hashem Mevorach. And in that moment, Rabbi Meir says, Hashem has given, God has given, God has taken, the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu should be blessed. What's the message of this Medrash? The message of the Medrash was, as painful as the circumstances were, Rabbi Meir and his wife found the koach to accept. These are our circumstances. And so we have a choice. You know, life often gives us circumstances we don't like. So some people spend their lives complaining. Some people spend their lives wagging that accusatory finger heavenward. Why me? Why me? Why did I deserve this? I always did everything good. You're right. You're wonderful. You did everything good. Life happens in a number of different directions for a variety of different reasons, often beyond our comprehension. So a person has a choice. A person could spend their lives complaining. A person, and for good reason, a person could spend their lives lamenting that they'll never have the life they thought they would or they wanted. And it's true. It's very sad. But where does all of that lamenting and where does all of that complaining get you? And the answer is nowhere. Instead, says Rabbi Meir, when life deals us something that is very difficult and very overwhelming, or something I never wanted, something I never thought I would have, the most important thing is acceptance. These are my circumstances. And if the moment I accept, this is very important, the moment I accept my circumstances is the moment that I am empowered to maximize my circumstances. You see, if I spend my life lamenting my circumstances, I'm always on the outside looking in. I'm over here, my circumstances are here, and I refuse to engage them because I don't want them. But if I accept them, if I accept what they are, then I engage them, and the moment I engage them, I have the ability to maximize them. Take a look at number 12. Look at the Medrash. So remember, now you begin to understand what's happening with Rabbi Akiva, what's happening with Rabbi Meir, what's happening with David HaMelech. All three of these great men share one common quality, which is the ability to accept circumstances, no matter how compromised they may be. The ability to accept, engage, maximize. That's the three-pronged approach to successful living. Accept the circumstances. By accepting them, I engage the circumstances. By engaging those circumstances, I have the koach, I have the power to maximize those circumstances. Look at the Medrash number 12. The Medrash says, remember, the pasuk that the Gemara quoted by Rabbi Akiva, was Babokir Zara Zaracha, Ula Erevat Tenach Yadecha. In the morning, sow the seeds, but in the evening, don't withdraw your hand. In other words, don't think that just because you planted in the morning, that you don't have to plant in the evening. You have to plant all of the time. Look what the Medrash writes, Hishalich Bitumecha. Hishalich Bitumecha. Walk Bitumecha. Tumecha means what? So Tumecha, if you notice, by the way, is the same word as number 13, Tamim. Tiam Hashem Elokecha. People translate the word Tamim as perfect. No, it's not perfect because God doesn't demand perfection because perfection is impossible for us. Tamim means to be complete, to be whole. So what does it mean? Hishalich bitumecha, go through life with a sense of wholeness and completion. Vitzei lizria, go out to seed. Vitzei l'ktzira, go out to harvest. What does it mean to go out in life bitumimus? Tamim tiam Hashem Elokecha, to be complete. Look at number 14. Rashi HaKadosh says over here, you know what it means to be tamim? Look what Rashi says. Elakoma sheyavo alecha. Whatever happens to you in life, kabel bitamimos. Accept it. Now, by the way, bitamimos means what? Tamimos means accept it with completion. What doesn't Rashi say? Accept it with joy. Rashi doesn't say accept it with simcha. Now again, there are some people who whatever HaKadosh Baruch Hu does to them, they always have a smile and they always say, thank you HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm in awe of people like that. But I think that they're the exception. They're not the rule. Rashi says, I don't have to have a smile on my face because sometimes life is exceptionally difficult. But you know what I do aspire to? Tamim tiyam Hashem Elokecha, whatever happens, kabel b'tamimos. Accept it. Accept it. Accept that this is my new reality. Because remember, if I don't accept my circumstances, that puts a strain on my relationship with God. If there's a strain on my relationship with God, I can't advance. I can't go anywhere more. But if I'm telling my attention, if I accept whatever God has given me, I'm not saying I'm happy with it. I might be very unhappy with it. But I accept that these are my new circumstances. Acceptance leads to engagement. Engagement ultimately allows me to maximize. This is my new life. This is my new life. These are my new circumstances. How do I maximize them? This is lesson number one that Rabbi Akiva teaches us. Rabbi Akiva, you want to understand, why is it that Rabbi Akiva was able, you understand, Rabbi Akiva, to begin with, was a late bloomer, as they say, right? 40 years old, it's very young. 40 years old, he didn't know Aleph Beis, right? 40 years old, he knows nothing. He goes up, and Rabbi Akiva has a very turbulent life, a very difficult life. He married a wonderful woman, but the truth is, they spent very little time together in the beginning stages of their marriage because she invested in him, right? Ultimately, she understood the man she married was a future, not just Gadol Hadar, not just the other generation, Rabbi Akiva goes on that list on one hand, of the great personalities throughout the entirety of our people. That's who Rachel understood that she was married to. They sacrificed an incredible amount. Incredible amount. Rabbi Akiva has an exceptionally turbulent life. And at the end of his life, and remember again, it doesn't get easier, it only gets harder. Rabbi Akiva dies a brutal death at the hands of the Romans. In fact, again, it's amazing. You know, the prison where Rabbi Akiva was tortured and killed is in Caesarea. You can go in Caesarea. They have the ruins of the Roman prison where they carried out Hadrianic persecution. We know exactly where Rabbi Akiva, not the exact spot, but the area where Rabbi Akiva was killed. Rabbi Akiva died in a Hadrianic prison, in a dungeon in Caesarea. That's where his life ends. That's where his life ends, away from his family, away from his people. Barbaric, barbaric persecution. But yet, so Rabbi Akiva loses 24,000 students. His entire life work. His entire life work goes down the drain. Entire life evaporates. You understand what it means to lose your entire life's work, everything you worked for. In a span of 49 days, you see it disappearing before your very eyes. Besides, what does that mean for me, Rabbi Akiva? What does that mean for me? I'm a flawed teacher. I'm not a good role model. What does it mean? But yet, what does he do? These are my circumstances. Bless you. This is it. This is it. Now, I have nothing. I have nothing to show for all of my life work after all of these years. So I have a choice. The choice is, I can go ahead and cry, and he would have good reason to cry. I'm sure he did cry. I could go ahead and say, you know what? I tried. Ribbono Shel Olam, you obviously have different plans. I put in my effort. I'm buying a place in Boca now, and I'm done. You know what? I did my best. I did my best, and there's nothing more I can do. He could have done that, and he would have been within his right to do that, but he doesn't do that. Life has deprived me of my life work. It's time to plant some more. It's just time to play. It hurts. Of course it hurts. You think Rabbi Akiva for a second didn't think about those 24,000 Talmidim? Do you understand? You know, when you speak about 24,000 Torah scholars died, do you know how many widows that is? It's at least 24,000. You know how many orphans? You know how many orphans there are? And who do you think became their surrogate father? Who did they come to cry to? They came to cry to their husband's Rebbe, to Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva becomes the father of all of these children overnight. Rabbi Akiva becomes the counsel to these broken-hearted widows overnight. This is not just he lost students and then he moved on. This, he saw families destroyed. He saw people living the rest of their lives broken-hearted. But he says to himself, I have a choice. The choice is I could sit there and I could cry with them, which I'm sure he did much of the time. But I have to plant some more. I have to plant some more. These are my circumstances. This is the hand that life has dealt me. But I have to try to figure out. The first batch of crops didn't survive. The first crops were decimated. I have to go back out to the field. I have to find fertile soil. And I have to plant a little bit more. If you take a look at number 15. So the Me'iri says something over here, something amazing. The Me'iri says to build on this. And this is lesson number one. We must accept the reality of our circumstances. Accept, engage, and maximize. That's Rabbi Akiva. If you look at number 15, the Me'iri takes this one step further. The Me'iri writes, Lama Torah Bialdusi quotes the Gemara. He says, So how you lo tamidim bialdusi? Yele b'ziknuso. So the Me'iri writes, look at the underlined line. Shepamim. Why do you, if you have students in your youth, you still have to establish students in your old age. Why? Shepamim, sheosim shebialdusam mesim. Because sometimes the students of my youth die. Uboim osim shebiziknuso umashlimin. And sometimes it's the students of my old age umashlimin. Mashlimin means what? They complete. So of course, if you just read the Me'iri quickly, so you can see what the Me'iri is saying is sometimes the efforts of my youth don't yield fruit, and it's the efforts of my old age that do. So keep on planting, keep on doing, keep on producing. But I was intrigued by this word umashlimin, because mashlimin means sometimes the efforts of my youth ultimately fail, and the efforts of my old age come umashlimin and complete the circuit, complete the unit. Perhaps what the Me'iri is saying is the following. We actually, this next piece we did in a different shir, so I didn't put the whole piece here. I just want to show it to you. If you look at number 16, so remember the pasuk in Parshas Ki Tsetse, ultimately speaking about the obligation to remember that which Amalek did to us. So remember again, the Torah points out something very interesting. Zachor is asher asalocha Amalek v'der b'tzer Mitzrayim. Remember what Amalek did to you. Remember what Amalek did to you when you left Egypt. And remember again, after telling that, the Torah says, pasuk yotes, and it will be when Hashem brings you to your land and takes away your enemies and allows you to be settled in the land. Timcha zecha Amalek, erase Amalek, lo tishkach, don't forget. So remember again, all of the mefarshim, all of the commentaries ask one simple basic question, which is, if the Torah is already telling me to remember, then what? Why does it have to say, don't forget? That's obvious. I mean, if you tell me to remember, it means I can't forget. Why do you have to say both? And if you remember again, in number 17, this is a beautiful piece by Rav Ashri. Rav Ephraim Ashri was a Rav on the Lower East Side in New York. He was the Rav of Shulchan Beis Medrash HaGadol. But before that, his most exalted position was he was Rav of the Kovna Ghetto. After Rav Achanan Wasserman Hashem Yikom Damo was executed by the Lithuanians at the Ninth Fort, so Rav Ashi became the de facto Rav of the Kovna Ghetto. And people used to come to Rav Ashi with all types of questions, and Rav Ashi would answer them without Sfarim. He recorded all of the questions on pieces of paper, and he hid it in a canister in the ghetto. Rav Ashi did not think he would survive. So he hid the canister somewhere in the ground in the ghetto, and he gave instructions to people, if anybody survives, come back, retrieve these documents, and let the people see the strength and the eternality of Klal Yisrael. Rav Ashi Baruch Hashem survived the war. He came back and he unearthed the canister and he compiled all of these questions that he received during the war into a set of responses called Chalos Hatshuvos Me'Ma'amak, in response from the depth. But what he did after the war is he went back and he put in essentially all the notes. Remember, he answered all of these questions without access to Svar, without access to any basic texts. So after the war, he went back and he bolstered his halachic arguments with various sources. It's a 6-volume series called Chalos Hatshuvos Me'Ma'amak, absolutely amazing. So in the introduction to the 3rd volume, so Rav Ashi deals with this question. And he discusses why is it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us to remember. Why does he remind us, Lo Tishkach, don't forget, even though he told us to remember. And Rav Ashi says something amazing. I'm going to tell you this outside, because we've done this before. Rav Ashi says something amazing. He says that we're never going to forget. He says, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us to remember what Amalek did to us, of course, remember, Rav Ashi's frame of reference with Amalek is much stronger and much personal, as his connections between Amalek and the Nazis, Yimach Shemam V'Zichram. So Rav Ashi says, could anyone tell us that we should remember what Amalek did to us? Of course, remember what Amalek did to us. The numbers are tattooed in our arms, our families are broken, our wives are not here, our children are not here, our husbands are not here, our parents are not here, our extended family. How could we? Of course we remember what Amalek did to us. But if you look, says Rav Ashi, something amazing. What does the Torah say? God says, one day, I'm going to settle you back in the land. Right? One day, I'm going to settle you back in the land. And one day, ultimately, again, you're going to be successful. If you look at paragraph Gimel, on the next page, it says, you know what's going to happen, says Rav Ashri. Speak to the community of survivors. The day is going to come where you're going to rebuild your families in Eretz Hashem. We're going to rebuild, and we're going to be successful in business, and we're going to be wealthy, and we're going to be influential, and we're going to have all the trappings of happy life all around us. And in those moments, Rav Ashri is going to say, we're going to say to ourselves, you know what the best thing we can do for ourselves is? To forget. Because sometimes, what's the point of tethering yourself to the pain of the past? Right? That pain is like a ball and chain. That pain brings me down. So says Rav Ashri, there's going to come a point in time where I'm going to say to myself, in order for me to fully self-actualize, in order for me to grow, I have to create what Rav Ashri calls a kav. Lahavir kav is in paragraph Gimel. I'll call my shavra. I have to draw a line. Let me draw a line between me and between all the misfortunes of the past. What is the point of always remembering? What is the point, ultimately, again, of always dwelling in this painful past? Let's let the past be the past. And Rav Ashri has, Rav Ashri says many things. He says there's going to come a time, and this is amazing, he's going to come a time where we're going to buy Volkswagens, Rav Ashri said, because we're going to forget that the company Volkswagen supplied the parts for the crematorium and the gas chambers. We're going to forget. We're going to come a point in time where ultimately, again, we're going to forget about all of these things. Because, and he goes on, he says, because this isn't human nature. Human nature is that how long do I need to be tethered to the pain of the past? And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to us in the Torah, even when I settle you in your land, even when you're successful, even when you're happy, lo tishkach, don't forget. Because says Rav Ashi to the community of survivors, you never forget your pain. Do you know why? Because our pain makes us who we are. You see, we often think that tragedy in life is a handicap. Oh, if only I didn't have tragedy, adversity, and difficulty, I'd be so much of a more whole, together person. Says Rav Ashri, it's not true. The circumstances of our lives, yes, the good ones as well as the negative ones, those are the events that make us who we are. If we try to forget those pieces of our life that are difficult and tragic, then we deny our ability to fully self-actualize. So therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, go back to number 16 for just a moment. So God therefore says, that what? Lo tishkach. Even once you're settled in the land, and you're prosperous, and you're successful, and you're autonomous, and people are afraid of you, nevertheless, says Rav Ashi, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us, lo tishkach. No, don't set aside, don't draw the line between yourself and your pain. Your tragedies, your difficulties, your challenges, those are part of who you are, and those make you who you are. If you own that pain helps to shape my entire identity, my entire gestalt. That's what the Meiri is saying. Go back to number 15 for just a moment. The Meiri is saying that what is Rabbi Akiva teaching us? Shepam sha'osan shebialdu so. There are times, ultimately, again, where the efforts of my youth don't bear fruit. Sometimes the students of the youth die. Uboim osam shebiziknuso umashlimim. My later, see, here's the idea. So often we see this Gemara and we say, okay, if the students of the youth died, you go ahead and you bring new students, teach new students, and everything is all better. Says the Meiri, no. It's not supposed to be all better. The idea is that the new students, combined with the pain of the past, mashlimin, that makes me into a whole person. You see, this is very important because we live in a society that teaches us that we're not supposed to feel pain. Not supposed to feel pain. If something is bothering you, let me prescribe something. I don't mean like physical pain. I'm talking about emotional pain that we're not supposed to feel. It's not true. Judaism believes we're supposed to feel pain. We just have to channel it in the right way. Meaning, the goal is not to feel pain. The goal is, as we said before, to ultimately accept engage and maximize pain. I have to own my tragic circumstances and figure out a way to shape them and to channel them into something productive, something meaningful. Says the Miri, that was the greatness of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva had students of his youth and they died. And he established new students. So what do you think? Everyone lived happily ever after because he had new students now? No. It's that he took the successes of his old age, coupled them with the pain of his youth, and that together created the whole Rabbi Akiva personality. It's only if we accept, engage, and maximize our pain, combining with the successes of life, then we have a total and complete personality. To try to draw the line between myself and my negative occurrences in life means to deny a part of who and what I am. If you skip down a little bit, now I begin to understand. So now we understand the pain of Lag BaOmer. The pain of the Omer is the pain of ultimately putting so much effort into building a life and seeing that life come crumbling down around you. You know, historically, by the way, the death of Rabbi Akiva's students is not the only pain that occurred ultimately during the Omer. You know that historically during the Omer, the communities of Shum, of Spire, Worms, and Mainz were destroyed during the First Crusade in 1096 during the Omer. That's why the Tefillah of Avarachamim that we say before Musaf on Shabbos, which is a Tefillah that was composed for those who died al Kiddush Hashem, those who died sanctified, was written in response to the massacre. This is during the First Crusade, the massacres of the communities of Shum. Shum is an acronym for Shum, for Spires, Worms, and Mainz. So much tragedy. This is the time of year. It's during this time between Pesach and Shavuos that we see so often historically that great things that people spent lifetimes building up came crumbling down. But this goes back to what the Rav said before as well. We go from Pesach, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes care of everything. God choreographs, and it's beautiful, and it's perfect, and it's wonderful. By the way, just to understand how perfect Pesach is, there's a beautiful custom that many have on Pesach, which is that after Mariv, on the first night of Pesach, families are often not very keen on this minhag, but it's a beautiful minhag. There's a minhag to say Hallel in shul on the first night of Yom Tov after davening. What? Yeah, such a strange minhag. Why? There's so much happiness on Pesach. I'm going to say Hallel just a little bit at the Seder. Why not to say it now? Because my soul is bursting with happiness. Because it's great. God is taking care of everything. It's magnificent. And then what happens on the second day of Pesach? I have barley. That's what I have on the second day of Pesach. Because the second day of Pesach is the transition, the Rav said, from the transcendental to the mundane. Now suddenly again, I'm in charge, I'm responsible, I have to take ownership over my life. That's the sadness of the Omer. The sadness, the mourning of the Omer is that so many times in life we put in so much effort, be it as individuals or as a collective, and we see the fruits of our labor wither up and die. That sometimes a person could spend a lifetime trying to accomplish something and I see it all coming down right in front of me. But herein lies the Simcha of Lag BaOmer. Take a look at number 20. The Medrash says something very beautiful. The Medrash says, Rabbi Akiva Omer, Shnei Masar Alofim Talmidim Hayulo Mikvas Vadan Tipros, V'kulon Mesu B'chaye Ben Pesach La'atzeres. Listen to this. So remember, like we saw before, number 20, all the students of Rabbi Akiva died during the Omer, from one end of the country to the other. And look at these words. The Medrash adds in additional words that the Gemara does not. The Medrash has three words. U'basof Yomim Elu. Besof Yomim Elu means what? At the end of these days, which days? At the end of the days that Rabbi Akiva, the first day that Rabbi Akiva doesn't have a levaya, the first day that Rabbi Akiva doesn't have to bury a student, what does he do? He'emidu li shiva. He went ahead and he established 7 new Talmidim. So you understand that according to the Medrash, what day was it that Rabbi Akiva went ahead and started shaping new students? Lag BaOmer. The 33rd day of the Omer is when Rabbi Akiva, when the first day that didn't have a Levaya, the first day that he didn't have to bury a student, the first day that he didn't have to do Menachem Havel, the first day that he didn't have to comfort orphans, that first day is the day that he goes out to go ahead and establish new Talmidim. You want to know what the Simcha of Lag BaOmer is? The Simcha of Lag BaOmer is the triumph of the human spirit. The Simcha of Lag BaOmer is the ability to keep planting. even when you've seen all of your crops be totally decimated. The simcha of Lag BaOmer is the ability to accept, engage, and maximize your circumstances. The simcha of Lag BaOmer is the ability to say, I'm not going to let tragedy own me. I'm going to own and channel my tragic circumstances. The simcha of Lag BaOmer is the strength of the individual to overcome and to maximize even the most compromised of circumstances. That's Lag BaOmer. And now you begin to understand the wording of the Shulchan Aruch. If you go all the way back, remember, what did we speak about almost an hour ago? Number three, the Shulchan Aruch, when it speaks about Lag BaOmer, what does it say? He says, Al Mesabi Lag BaOmer, Umar bin Bo, Kitzas Simcha. Kitzas Simcha. So it doesn't mean, you know, because Lag BaOmer is a strange day, because the graves are still fresh, the hearts are still broken, everything is so sad. But it's also the day that reminds us that no matter how difficult circumstances become, we will always find the koach as individuals and as a collective to persevere. That no matter what happens in life, no matter how painful the circumstance, I'll always find the ability to accept, engage, and maximize. That no matter what happens to me in life, I have role models like Rabbi Akiva, like David HaMelech, like Rabbi Meir and his wife. I have people that teach me that often life does not go my way, but I'm not going to yield. I'm not going to succumb. I'm not going to throw my hands up. I'm not going to spend my life complaining and lamenting for what could have and should have been, but I'm going to find the strength to maximize my circumstances. That's the kitzas simcha of Lag BaOmer. That's the kitzas simcha of this day. The first day that there was no levaya, the first day that Rabbi Akiva had the opportunity to say, I'm owning these circumstances, and I know I've just seen all of the crops be washed away by a torrential downpour and flood, but I'm going to find the strength to plant again. So we should be zochem Yirtzeh Hashem, as we celebrate this Yom Tov of Lag BaOmer, and we celebrate the strength of Rabbi Akiva, his Tamidim, Rabbi Meir David HaMelech. You know, we all have circumstances like this. Maybe not as dramatic as Rabbi Akiva's, but all of us have crops that we have planted that have simply not grown. Either they haven't grown at all, or it's grown into something else, or we've just seen them washed away by the torrents of life. And often there's Yetzer Hara to give up and to give in. But Emir Tashem, in the zuchus of having a little bit of simcha on this Lag BaOmer, in the zuchus of rejoicing over Rabbi Akiva's strength, Avraham Melech's strength, Rabbi Meir's strength, that we should be zuchus, Emir Tashem, that even if what we have planted until now has not exactly sprouted or come to life the way we had envisioned, we should be zochem Yirtzeh Hashem to plant again and to continue to plant until 120.